On this edition of Discologist, Eduardo and Kevin are exploring music across all ends of the spectrum, and the results are the best 550th episode of Discologist that anyone could have hoped for. Artists Aaron Abernathy, Prefuse 73, The Mesthetics with James Brandon Lewis, and The Mad Archaic all have a part to play in this journey. But I am most excited that my AI friend Suno is debuting their new single entitled Conversations of Chaos on this very show. Will you be able to tell the difference? Tune in to find out. And with those formalities out of the way, welcome. Your experience begins now.
Very loud. Was that an air raid siren warning us that a culture
You know why everybody's cheering today, right?
Does it have to do with Beyonce?
No, it doesn't. Okay. But it might. Episode 550. Mm-hmm. Some people
the double in the audience, nickel 55.
Some people in the audience might know something we're gonna announce at the end that's coming up.
So that's
good. And three people heard the lake and are happy that I'm gonna shut the fuck up about it. so thank you. I think about maybe 12 people bought it.
And
streamers and stuff. And you know, this was an experiment. The experiment is kind of over. I don't know how other artists do this, but like, look, it's out. I've done a lot of work on this thing, and going forward, it's just like, if people want to talk to me, I'm like, fuck yeah, I'll talk to you. But like, it's not something keep pursuing. Like, this is in my past now.
Except, well, yes, and
yeah,
it also, I think, has probably changed you and your perspective a little bit, and I think it probably will continue to do that, and you may not. You know, that'll be a fun sort of thing to...
No, for sure it does that. Although a lot of that happened... Like, this last phase certainly did. Yeah. You know, we've talked a lot about how scenes support each other and how you can support artists and blah, 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 blah. And I had a lot of theories, proved a lot of them right, some of them wrong. But, you know, for the most part, if you want a broad overview of where I am at with the music industry right now, which we're going to get into when we talk about one thing today, it's no surprise that it's failing because people have forgotten in general in society how to support the things that they claim to support.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we don't need to get into it because we've talked about this like just forever on this show.
Right.
Like, if you want to support an artist, give him money. That's it.
Yeah.
You like what you hear today? Go out and buy whatever we talk about. It is that simple. Yep. Everything else is vibes, and vibes aren't worth shit if you're like trying to make a living. Like, I can't. I can't get another guitar on vibes.
Not yet.
I wish I could.
Not yet.
Some people can. We have talked to some people who can do that, but
yes,
you know,
it's the next cryptocurrency is vibes.
Vibes?
Vibe coin.
You have like a vibe wallet?
And you don't, you just create vibes yourself. You don't have to go out. You don't have to, there's no vibe farm. You just,
well, how much energy does that require? Like, is that going to exhaust our like pudding resources?
Well, here's the thing. It actually vibes give you energy. So it violates, it violates the laws of thermodynamics.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
I like this. Before we get to like, well, we got some great music today. We're talking about Prefuse 73. We're talking about Aaron Abernathy, The Mesthetics, and your brother.
I know.
Which is great.
The
Mad Archaic.
The Mad Archaic.
And AI. But, you know, you've been in the background of this whole lake thing from inception. What did you learn seeing this process?
First of all... you know, I think especially that you know, in the last few weeks where you were really sort of gearing up for your release, right? And like pulling together all of the pieces for that. So you know, everything from like the great copy that Quinn wrote.
Yeah.
All the way to navigating the sort of the preview session. It gave me a whole new respect for all the pitches we get in our inbox. And
yeah.
You know, and the fact that there's someone like looking at those numbers and trying to make sense of them and what it means that people are listening to or not listening to something. It made me kind of like nervous for you. Like, it's such a vulnerable thing to do, to put, you know what I mean? Like, it was just,
well, I think this is why you hire people, right?
It's a hell of a thing to watch someone you know and love go through, where you're just like, man, this is just, Kevin's really putting himself out there. This is incredibly brave.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's brave, but it's important if you want to engage in capitalism. It's not brave. It's just like, it's part of the job that sucks. Part of your job sucks. Part of my real job sucks. It's just like, there's things you do in a job that you're just like, I hate that part. But you do them so you can do the part that you like. Hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully. So, yeah. The one thing that I didn't engage in is there's a thing where you can send out links to everybody, but you can like track it to their name. And that's so fucking creepy.
Yeah. I don't think.
But I understand now more why people often don't even like check on stuff, because the second you do, like I tested it on you, and the second you open that email, it sent me a response back that said, Eduardo has done this, he's listened to these songs, and he's downloaded it. Wow. And so if you're a PR guy on the other end of that, you're looking at that going, okay, did they listen to it once? Do I need to hit them up? How does that balance for like what size coverage am I going to get? Like, how much coverage? Is it really important to follow up, or do I even give a fuck? I will say we're in the free Bandcamp code phase of things now, which is always funny. Somebody asked me why, because one of the albums we're talking about today, Abs, he priced for free, which is fine. That's a fine decision. But mine is $10. And the reason is, if you're going to talk about artists getting paid, you have to be willing to pay yourself. And, you know, the argument against is just simply that, oh, well, you know, maybe it's exposure, maybe somebody will hear it and then buy it. But I put the value on this record that I think it's worth.
Yeah.
And zero regrets. Did that cost me sales? I don't know. $10 for a digital album? Kind of a lift.
I mean, that's really, you know, it's crazy to think that when iTunes first came along, like, albums were $9.99. Right, that was the sort of like there might have been like a double record that might have gone for like $12.99 or something, but that $10 per record is, how old is that now? Like 20 years?
Yeah.
Right, like it's like the minimum wage. It just hasn't changed in,
well,
God knows how long.
If you're a bargain hunter, you can go on iTunes and Amazon and get it for like $7.
Yes,
unless you have over a certain amount of songs. The max you can charge on iTunes is $1.29 a song.
So you can buy the individual tracks and have it come out to less than that.
Yeah. So that's why they do the full thing is only that, which is really anti what we know about capitalism. Like, they should be like, maybe we'll trick somebody. You can get each track for $1, but really, if you want the album, pay 30.
You know, I think we're going to keep, I mean, it's funny to think about, and this, We'll certainly hit on this, I think, with the topics today, but like, we know so little about consumer behavior in the pre-digital age, and in some ways, like, we still know so little about this, right? We in theory have like much more, you know, you can get super granular and sort of identify like what percentage of you know, what percentage of streams go to the top 5% of streaming artists or whatever. But so much has changed about the way we consume music, right? I think a couple weeks ago, you and I were talking about like the end of terrestrial radio. So probably, you know, a bunch of people, like, if your vibe is, you know, I don't know, the Chili Peppers and Maroon 5 and, you know, now Taylor Swift and whatever's on the radio, like, you probably didn't have to buy those albums. You just listened to them on, you know, on terrestrial radio.
You heard the good singles.
Yeah. And so the fact that they're getting streams now to me is almost this sort of like meaningless thing of just like, well, they're just like the people who listen to those things just want, you know, they're a certain kind of listener. They're a different profile. Yeah. And they're getting now from streaming what they used to get for free from radio, right?
I was going to say, I remember back in the day when I first heard the song Amanda on the radio by Boston. Uh-huh. And I was going to say that I was so disappointed that I bought the album and Amanda was the only good song. But look, it's a motherfucking masterpiece. So that's not a good example. Maybe like the Outfields Play Deep. Prince's Purple Rain, not a great example either. But there were certainly albums. In the, you know who? Mike and the Mechanics.
Mm, sure.
Three great songs on that album, on the debut album. But like you heard them on the radio and you saw the video. But then if you picked up your album like halfway through, you're like, what is this shit?
Bunch of stinkers.
Yeah. Which we're still, that's how we make albums. You know, I would say, I won't use the word stinker, but half of someone's new country album might not be that great.
You know, I've gotten all the way through it once. I think the least interesting thing about that record is the genre label question. I just can't imagine caring that much about it one way or another. Because to me, the conversation is so weird to be like, because it depends on, so if someone says something is or isn't country, I have like five follow-up questions about what they consider to be country.
Yeah.
Right?
Or any genre.
Yeah. And so if I'm talking to someone and their frame of reference is they're really into like Del McCurry and Ricky Skaggs and they're coming from the bluegrass side of things, like they're going to think one set of things. Mm-hmm. If they're coming at it from the, you know, alt country Americana, they're going to think a whole other set of things about what, you know, what is and isn't country. And it's really just so silly that, there is this, that I guess that country still, you know, Nashville sort of charts based country still thinks of itself as being different from pop. That's really the thing that I just cannot get over, is this idea of like, well, we're a different type of pop and like our pop doesn't overlap with other pops.
And I think that's where the album lands. So, I mean, you know, for a second we considered discussing it at length, but we don't really need to. I mean, here's what my take on it is. It's just Beyonce makes big albums. This is overly long. It's 80 minutes, 27 tracks. But that kind of tracks for what Beyonce does. It's not a country album, but it is a deconstruction of what we think of genres and a concept album about that, which is fascinating. So when she does these things, like I'm not commenting on the internet today because I can't say this on the internet, you know, because people are like, you hate black people, which is what the response is, which is what she did is she did in fact bring a lot of black country artists into this album who country radio otherwise will not play. That doesn't make it a country album. That makes her awesome. That makes this whole thing great. And so as that, I appreciate that someone that has this big, this far into her career and has this much control over market share in music is willing to take a swing like this. And people can think it's cynical or whatever, but look, an 80-minute, 27-song album about what the fuck do genres even mean is a pretty big swing.
You know, I kept thinking about that Saturday Night Live sketch from a couple years ago that was predicated on the idea that, like, white people were learning that Beyonce was black for the first time, right? Which was a very, very well-executed sketch. On this album, when we got to the second track, I think the second track is Blackbird, right?
It is.
And I was like, oh, Beyonce is just coming for basically like white culture writ large musically. Yes. And she's just like saying like, I'm going to take, and in the same way that like, if you go see a go-go band, they're going to go in and out of call and response of songs that are not theirs that span the entire history of popular music in general, but black popular music in particular. And it's all sort of fair game. And I sort of had this idea that like a little bit of what Beyonce is doing is kind of saying, all right, you know, I've sort of stayed in a different lane for a little bit. Like I did glossy pop, I've done R&B, I've done like artsy R&B and kind of more ratchet shit. And like, now I'm just going to come for straight up white culture. I'm going to have a hit with Miley Cyrus. I'm going to cover the Beatles and Dolly Parton.
Yep.
And that's kind of, yeah, I mean, that's a cool, like fucking do it, you know? I'm super into that. I'm super into that.
Exactly. The results don't have to be, you don't have to be like, I love all the results.
Right.
Right. Which effect she made that and other people don't, you know?
Yeah.
And the big reason is money. She has the money to do it, but that aside, that's still like to my mind, a phenomenal, like, flex for any artist to be like, yeah, I'm just going to fuck up everything.
Yeah. No, and to be clear, like, there's a track with, like, a Brazilian baile funk DJ. So we're not saying it's not country, like, casually. Like, it's a lot of things. It is also in, you know,
it's
in
a lot of things.
Or
yeah.
For stretches, it is also country. But I'm not going to think of this as Beyonce's country record.
No. Texas Hold'em was country. The rest, probably not.
Yeah, right.
So the question then that brings up is, could AI possibly create this? Uh-huh. If Beyonce is like has access to the history of music and is pulling it with help into her music and exploring it and commenting on it while she's doing that. There's a new service called Suno. Rolling Stone did a article on it that was quite frankly horrifying, and fuck the guys who run Suno. Like, these are the worst of the worst people. But it is a fascinating insight into what I think might be our collective doom. You're not so sure about this.
I'm less doomer about this, but we can get there.
But what it is, you can, you know what AI is, everybody. You know what ChatGPT is. So this is ChatGPT for songs. You can go and you can type in whatever phrase you want, whatever. You can type in full lyrics now. You can't type in exact artists, so you can't tell it to make a Beyonce song.
Mm-hmm.
I tried with Pink Floyd. It didn't work.
Okay.
You do that and you wait about 3 or 4 minutes and it spits out a reasonable song. Now before, and you made the face, and a lot of people are making the face like, oh no. I mean, this is everybody's response to AI up until this point. Well, I have not heard anything that like convinces me. It's all like janky and whatever. So I made a song.
Yeah, I haven't heard this song, but I have heard other things from Suno that I thought were,
right. You haven't heard this.
Like a big step forward for this.
Yeah, I made a song. It may or may not contain spoilers for another episode. but I'm just going to play it and let you guys hear it.
Let's do it.
And I'm sorry to say that the AI made this already, because that kind of spoils it. But this is our new hit, Conversations of Chaos.
Wow.
Conversations of Chaos.
Yeah, I didn't realize that there was a Master of Puppets outtake about our forthcoming interview with Bill Frisell. I don't know.
I don't know how these guys did that.
It
was one of the super, super, super secret deluxe editions that you can only get on Nina Protocol on the blockchain. Like, he just got, it's about the blockchain, man. So that was 100% created. My prompt was metal song about the genius of Bill Frisell. And that's what it came back with in 5 minutes. There's another version of it that's more like a power ballad. I preferred this one. And so what this does is kind of, to my mind at least, immediately threatens to wipe out what we refer to as commercial music. And these are real, you know, I've heard somebody refer to them as hacks. They are not. These are real musicians doing real fucking work. And, you know, and they depend on ad companies. They depend on movies. They depend on television. All these things to, like, commission them and say, we need a piece. And it might be a piece. We need a piece to sound like Marvin Gaye. We need a piece to sound like Steve. You know, but they still have the skill that they can do this. If you're an ad exec now and you don't know shit about shit and you have no ethics, which is, you know, C-suite, you know, generally, are you going to be looking at your world and be like, I would like to pay, for example, Louis Weeks $5K to $10K to do a piece of music or an $8 a month subscription?
Yeah. So, I think the way this plays out, I don't think we're going to know for a while how this plays out. So let me just start by saying, like, I don't think in sure. 6 months we'll be able to say, because I think there are, you know, one thing that is very much in vogue now, and you frankly see it all over the Beyonce record, for example, is crediting collaborators, crediting contributors, making sure that anyone who sort of who has a part to play on a song, and big artists like Beyonce and Taylor Swift apparently take this very seriously, right? It's sort of their thing now, is to, part of their brand is to make sure that they're acknowledging all of these people. You know, I think there's going to be some tension around that. I think what'll probably happen is there will be a commercial or a TV show or a movie that uses an AI generated score, and there will be backlash against that. And you know, will, you know, whether people will care or not will probably depend on who does that. Right. But I don't think it's going to be just as simple as, I don't think those shitty executives are going to get to make these decisions with impunity, because I think there will be, you know, there will be artists and other folks who will be very vocal about pushing back on this. And we've already seen this, right? Any artist who uses any kind of AI is going to face a backlash from their peers in the creative community. And I think this is, oh no, the artists are angry at us. What are we going to do? Right. Is probably what the executives are thinking, but, yeah. I don't think everyone is just going to roll over for this. First of all, second of all, you know, I don't know. There's like there's that Instagram account. There I ruined it, right? And they'll take sort of like different song, they'll sort of do a, like, what if we had Johnny Cash sing, you know, a Sir Mix-a-Lot song or something like that, right? And I saw that they were playing like live shows, and some part of me was like, who's gonna, you know, so it turns out there does seem to be like an audience for that, but like, I don't think it's ever really going to be, you know, I think about like the Girl Talk guy, right? Like, sure. He had about 4 years in which to get paid, because at some point people lost interest in that, because they realized
I would argue that in some point, like, there just became millions of Girl Talks.
Yes.
Like, that's mashups. It just, there was too much competition.
Yeah. And so he had a little bit of first mover advantage. But then as it became like so widely disseminated, like it also became a lot less interesting, right? I think there's a way in which like this stuff is so cheap and so widely available that it ends up having no value. And so I think there will be shocks to like, you know, this sector. I think people who do that kind of work, you're right, are going to feel a lot of pressure, and I'm certainly not trying to make light of that, but I don't think there's ever going to be a point. You know, I was watching something the other night, and a commercial came on for Expedia or something like that, and it used "I'll Be Your Mirror" by the Velvet Underground, and I don't know, you know, like it's very difficult for me to imagine a future where an AI generated song is going to have that emotional cachet to get people to perk up and respond to a commercial in a certain way. Not every commercial does that. But I think the point is like, there's still going to be a, like, people aren't going to be crowding bars in 50 years to play different AI generated songs. I think they're going to be, I think there'll be people who won't realize that they're listening to AI generated songs, and they won't possibly care. And so in a lot of ways, I think, you know, artists that rely on like casual disengaged listeners, like the sort of terrestrial radio people, you know, maybe it'll be a little bit harder for them. Maybe it's easier for like a Maroon 5 to. But, you know, when we were texting about this earlier, like I saw the Rural Alberta Advantage earlier this week. They're not one of my favorite bands. They have one or two songs that I like. Yeah. There were people there. There were like five people around me for whom this show was like the event of the year. And just being in the same room as the band was so important.
Right.
And they knew all of the songs. And it was a really, you know, one of them was like easily the worst person I think I've ever seen at a show. I want to put out like a wanted poster. But then I stepped back and I was like, you know what? She's having a great night. And she's seeing this band that she clearly loves so much. And like, who am I to police the way she's enjoying it? So I have a very hard time imagining that AI is ever going to get to that point for people. And so so when it comes to like, you know, it's going to crater the whole music industry, I'm a little bit, you know, I'm not a doomer about this, because I think people still make mayonnaise by hand. You know, you don't need to, but people still choose to. People shoot on film these days, right? Like there's all these sort of like ways
you may
in which,
need to soon though, because you can't afford mayonnaise in a store though. That's the, you know, learning stuff. And I think, and you know, for people listening, we did discuss this extensively offline.
Yeah.
I do agree with your point to a point about people wanting like that human thing. I don't think it can wipe that out because individuals exist, unless everybody gets Neuralink and then it's all over. But I think, I can map out how it can destroy not just music, but pretty much every sector, like far too easily. And what it does is that model creates less opportunity for this. So it's not that people won't want to be in a bar with that band, right? It's just that band won't necessarily have the opportunity for anybody to ever hear them, because of the way we interact with the way we discover music now. You know, you don't discover music by somebody handing you a record anymore. You discover music by an algorithm. And so algorithmically created music fed into an algorithm is going to be like exponentially more potent than anything a human can do. Two can act, they interact. No.
But I'm thinking of how I know we've talked about this a couple of times. Our friend Drew, escalate tickets to Spotify saying, please stop feeding me Mac DeMarco. I don't want, So the algorithm was really working overtime to get us all to love Mac DeMarco. And like, it didn't really work. I mean, Mac DeMarco is probably doing fine, but like, you know, he's We were able to resist.
Well, we weren't, because Mac DeMarco is still everywhere. I get served Mac DeMarco. And yeah, the reason is because
people actually like him.
Yeah, I know. But the reason is because a lot of people actually like him, so it doesn't care anymore. Because at some point, this is profitable to a group that we don't see. Like, his success, and this is the music industry, right? You get above a certain level, and then it's important to people that we don't see, that you don't think about, that need this money. And you can look at it as Live Nation, you can look at it as Big Live, whatever you want to look at it as. But that is the part of the music industry that is just kind of dirty and nasty, and that's what I'm talking about, because at the end of the day, they also control all this. They can't stop somebody from making it. Like, nobody could stop me from making The Lake. They sure as shit can stop me from putting it out on any platform or for anybody to hear it, unless I want to walk it door to door. And that's where I feel the problems come in here. When you look at even just like ChatGPT, never mind this produces ready-made demos, basically. You think about a country music like Writing Room. If you're Laurie McKenna, this is maybe not going to affect you until a long time. But Nashville is a city populated by people trying to break into the writing business. So they get paid. They get paid an hourly rate and by song and all that. And they're commissioned by labels. They don't care about these people. They care about what they can produce. And I mean, it's just capitalism. You know, this is no different from capitalism, and why it's crushing everything. But if you're looking at that, let's say Big Machine, and you have a writer's room that has 20 people, and they meet once a week, maybe twice a week, and you're spending, $1 million a year on these people. And you can cut that down to like one or two people just working an hourly job. And I'm not saying it goes to that quickly. But I am saying it goes to that in 5 years, unless, and I don't even know how we would stop it, regulators. But I mean, the people with the money always end up on top, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's, so yes to all of that. I was reading something about how, in Silicon Valley now, what companies do, they're like decision tree. Oh, we have a problem, we have to solve it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Starts with, can we build an AI for it? And the last option is like, well, I guess we'll hire people, right? So the first thing is like, oh, can we build an AI to do it for us forever? Can we rent the specialty and have it built? Can we do something outsourced? And then at the very, very bottom is like, no, let's give a person a job. This is not... the entity that's supposed to solve this is government. And we are going to be, it's ridiculous how far behind we are in terms of the regulation here. I mean, I think the thing that, for example, everyone likes with AI generated art is that it includes some sort of indelible stamp that indicates that it was made by a machine and not by humans, right? So you can forever sort of keep it on that. And of course there will be bootlegs and there will be people trying to get around that, right? But like, you can still, I think, get to a point where that's the case. And, you know, and maybe there's an AI that's going to help us like stamp out bad AI. I don't know.
That's the thing. You know? It's so weird. I'm not anti-AI. I don't think people should. Like, you can take, say, like, MRI readings and feed it into an AI, and it will discover so much more information, potentially, than any human doctor can.
Yeah.
And, like, that's fucking amazing. But then how do we let that AI go and then crush this one? Because... you've also got on this, like, people who just need inspiration are going to use this.
Yeah.
Valid tool in my book. This is a 100% valid tool.
Yeah. I think it's hard for us to judge too, because we're so in the novelty phase, right? Every time we're looking at something AI, we're looking at it from the standpoint of like, ooh, can you tell it's AI? What is the AI doing? Right. At some point we're going to start seeing reality and deconstructing it based on like what inputs we would put into an AI prompt to create that, yeah. Right? So I think it's difficult for us to imagine like what things will be like in 20, 30, 50 years and what it'll be like for someone who grew up after all this stuff came along, right?
Exactly.
I can tell you like if I were playing, I don't know, if I put on music, I'm entertaining people and I'm like, hey, let's all check out this song, and I put something on, and if it were AI, people in the room would be uncomfortable. Like there would be this like, oh, that's weird. I don't know if I like that I'm listening to an AI thing.
See, this is what we talked about. I disagree with that because I put on the song that we just played and Daria did not know that I didn't make that, because that is something and technically I did.
Right. But that piece of information changes everything. Like the test to me isn't whether you can hear it and know that it's AI. The test is when you know that it's AI, do you feel the same way about it? Does it hold its interest?
And
the answer is almost never are you going to be interested in like, oh, what was the machine thinking or feeling when it did that, you know?
I don't know, man. I'm interested.
Yeah, right. But we're in the novelty phase. We want to know what it's capable of. I don't think it's going to have any, I don't think it's going to hold any sort of enduring power over our minds, because we know how complex the human brain is, and you know, sure, AI is going to be smart and capable and do all these other things, but like it's never going to feel pain. It's never going to really understand, you know, what it means to be human. And like, I just think that's never going to go away.
And we don't have time for that.
Yeah.
that's like the 5-hour cut of Until the End of the World.
Yeah.
But I would say, look at that film to see evidence that maybe that's not like true. It's philosophically is such a complex issue, because it assumes things about what being a human is. And that depends on what you think it is. And that gets into like theology, that gets into like your personal philosophy and all that. That's dirty business. and I'd love to talk about it, but we have music to listen to that's not made by AI. The only thing I can hope is that someday, maybe 50 years from now, that we have like an AI Bill Frisell. That we can't tell the difference. Like,
so he will always be there.
Keeps making records after he's gone. Not holograms; they suck. As he rightfully pointed out.
I was saying, like, people thought, oh, soon every concert's going to feature like a hologram guest star, and like it really only happened the one time. So,
No. But somebody who definitely isn't an AI, although,
do we know this?
You know, it's he just came up out of nowhere and dropped an album. Our friend Aaron Abernathy goes by the name of Ab. We've talked a lot about him on the show, specifically about his 2017 album Dialogue. It's a little triptych of albums. There's Monologue in 2016, Dialogue in 2017, which directly addressed the election of Donald Trump, and Epilogue in 2019. Now, Monologue and Epilogue are more about relationships and self-politics. Dialogue takes on national politics, being black in America. Directly, it is, I think, not just one of my favorite albums of all time. It's one of the most important albums I've ever heard. So if you haven't heard that, or listen to that record or our interviews with him, I will put links in the show notes. He's a fascinating dude. And I think his uncle was Ralph Abernathy.
Yes.
With Martin Luther King. Anyways. Ab's a rad dude, and he's been doing stuff. He's been working in commercial music, right? This is kind of how this ties in here. He's been doing this work, and he gets like sync licenses because he knows all about music, and he wants to make money making music. And I think what he ran into was that the grind of the record industry wasn't necessarily for him. He's a fantastic performer, but that's not how he defined it. Fame isn't going to define him, right?
Fair.
I think you know him well enough, too, to know that. Like, he's a really down-to-earth dude who's just hyper-talented.
Yeah.
So he has a new album out, From the Throne Room. It dropped on Monday.
Out of nowhere. This is out of
nowhere. Yeah, out of nowhere. It's fantastic.
You were like, so this happened. Yeah.
And what I love about this is two things. I talked to him a little bit about it. We're going to have him on the show probably in a few weeks. The other albums were all done in his home in DC. So a home studio album. They don't sound like that. They sound fucking amazing. But these albums are all done in his home. This one, he did a hybrid of home and studio. And I assume that's because his exposure to like doing the commercial music.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you have access to that and you work, you know, in that mode, and then you're going to do some stuff in there. You know, again, we're just getting into it, so we don't have a lot of commentary on it. I will say, it is an album, a collection of singles, less so than a concept of other stuff, which is, at first I was like, oh, what's this? Now I'm like, oh, this is great. It's a flex. He can do a lot of different things. But what I didn't know he could do was this track Rolling. And you can name some stuff when we come back of like who this hits. But listener, you're going to hear this. You're going to be like, holy shit, why isn't this on the radio? So here's Aaron Abernathy's Rolling from the Throne. Aaron Abernathy's Rolling off of From the Throne Room. That's a lot, man. That's, for me, that's fantastic.
High octane. I think, you know, that thinking about his trilogy of records, right? When I heard this, it sort of sent me back to Monologue a little bit, because that's a record that is so rooted in like his, it's like his growing up with like sort of traditional kind of, you know, old R&B. Right. And I think that's something that Monologue does very well. It's just sort of like incredibly solid neo, you know, retro R&B. And when this first started, I was just like, oh, what are we, is this like, and then as the full band kicks in, I sort of have these like Janelle Monáe flashes of like, is this right? Is this the future or is it the past? Is this like a sort of commentary on kind of big, you know, sort of Otis, James Brown, those kinds of things? Or is this like a cyborg doing them in the future? It really surprised me. I think I was listening to the record and I think I texted you and I was like, oh, this is like, there's a lot going on here. These songs, you know, Ab has such a great handle on hooks and groove, and he manages to pull those together in a way that kind of like, you know, his hooks augment the groove and his grooves sweeten the hooks. And that's not always something that, you know, it sounds so easy when you say it that way, but like he really just has this like uncanny ability to sort of marry rhythm and melody. And then when this song came on, I was just like, okay, I don't understand, you know, in a good way. I was like, I don't really know what this record is now.
And the song after Joy is the same way.
Yeah.
It's just like ready made to be like a top 40 hit and have his name just be everywhere. And he released it on Bandcamp, pay what you want.
Yeah.
Like, this is the crazy world we live in. I mean, anybody I know who's seen him do a show is like, kind of leaves changed from that show. They're like, holy shit. Like, it's the whole package. With what he does, I'm just super excited that he is, making albums again.
Yeah, no,
because he's been doing little. He's been doing an interesting thing too. He's releasing behind the scenes shit, like demos of tracks and stuff that was rejected from the commercial music and stuff that he's been working on. It's just a fascinating dude, fascinating artist, and I love that he's back doing this stuff.
I'm going to be listening to this record a lot, like this weekend, for example. It's supposed to be nice here. It's a really good, like, windows down, drive around record.
If you go to his Bandcamp, too, this might blow your mind. You can still get a vinyl copy of Dialogue.
Wow.
Which is...
That does...
insane.
Because I remember when I ordered that, it was like hand addressed by him when I got it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I love that record so much. My copy has like something where like the inside is cut a little tight, and so it always takes me like a little like shimmying to get it onto the platter.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I've tried to figure out like, can I just sort of sand that down a little bit? But it's a great little piece of the homespunness of that record. Yeah, Dialogue is a motherfucker of a record.
It really is.
Still is, yeah.
I listened to it the other day, and I'm just like, oh, wait, is this going to be, like, relevant again? And it was never not relevant, but like, oh, fuck, man.
Yeah.
Like, how much has changed and not changed since when he released it in 2017?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it came out, like, right after the election.
Came out during a dark time, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah. So Aaron Abernathy's thing. Should we stick around DC?
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about this Mesthetics and James Brandon Lewis record.
Cool.
That also just dropped. So the Mesthetics are a really interesting little trio here. It's Joe Lally and Brendan Canty, who are the rhythm section of Fugazi. With Anthony Pirog, who is basically like, what? He's like Steve Vai, but not insufferable. I mean, he's like a guitar whiz.
Danny Gatton, I think.
Danny Gatton, yes.
Yeah, and he plays every year at a Danny Gatton thing that I think he threw it at the Birchmere. Gatton stuff. And we're friends. At least I'm friends with his brother Kenny.
Yeah.
And
you and I saw like one of the first Mesthetics shows. It was like a tune-up show at the Dewdrop Inn.
Oh, were you there? I was trying to. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. We taped an episode, and then you and I went over there together.
That's right. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It was a very fun night. I've seen them a handful of times around DC. I actually just saw Lally and Canty backing up Lonnie Holly too, and I came away really impressed with what they can do as a rhythm section. I mean, I think they're. Your mileage may vary on Fugazi, but one of the things I always thought was really important about them was just how rhythmically tight that band was. And I think a lot of punk bands can sound a little messy or sloppy. And I just always thought Fugazi had like such a great, well-defined pocket. And here they've teamed up with James Brandon Lewis, who's a sax player. He's really a sort of, he's a jazz guy, but like not a, he's like a jazz guy who sort of pushes boundaries a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm not, you know, I don't know enough. I don't have this record, so I don't know the story of like how these guys all came together to do this, but it's really interesting for me to imagine that you have this sort of like, you know, punk, jazz, krautrock section in the Mesthetics combined with the chops of a real sax player, you know.
I can tell you how they came together. He went to Howard.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And so he was a DC guy for a really long time. So that I think he's in New York now. But yeah, he went to Howard, and I think in like 2006. So
Well, this is, I just saw them aesthetics, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 months ago. I'm seeing these guys with James Brandon Lewis tonight in show one of the night. And so I thought it was, you know, and I also realized that like a lot of people seem to not know, a lot of people who like Fugazi seem to not know that that Lolly and Canty have sort of evolved into this like quasi jam band rhythm section.
Yeah.
So we're going to listen to Three Sisters off of this record. It's a nice slow little number, a little moody. We'll see how we feel about it. Well, that was Three Sisters from The Aesthetics and James Brandon Lewis. It's out on Impulse. I have some sort of weird feelings about this record, and I think you do too, right, Kevin?
Yeah, I think I love the first record, self-titled Anthropocosmic Nest in 2019. A little more out there. A lot of that is had to do with Anthony Parag's playing. Mm-hmm. Which is fantastic, but it's also like very, he uses a lot more distortion than a typical like jazz guitar, you know, would use, but he also isn't necessarily doing fusion. You expect that distortion in like fusion. And you know, I will say live, this band to me is unstoppable. I mean, you see him live and it's just fantastic. You think of how many years combined all these guys have playing shows. Like they know how to perform. All the albums before this were on Discord, and this one is on Impulse. So that's where I kind of am wondering what is going on, because I enjoy the album, but it also sounds it veers into that jam jazz. You mentioned jam bands, the jam jazz type of thing, where not everybody is really, I don't want to say good enough, but they're a little lower than like jazz, and maybe a little higher than like the jam Elvis. It's just in between zone never ever really sit well with me, which is just my own personal bias. But I mentioned the band Ulu before, and I have weird feelings about them. I mean, it's the same type of thing where you're like, wow, these guys can really play, but maybe it's this is a stretch. And I think on this, it sometimes does feel like a stretch. The quieter songs are nice. They're super nice. The louder songs, I don't know how much they really give you, but this could be personal bias. I
agree with all of that. I mean, I think what I've found listening to them aesthetics is that, you know, while, Pyrog is definitely, you know, just sort of, unique, a uniquely talented guitarist, I find myself sort of craving, you know, a lead melody or something that gives me a little bit more. And I thought on this record that James Brandon Lewis would help them find that. But I still feel a little bit like the record leaves me wanting something that I'm not quite getting from it. And maybe I'll get that when I see them tonight.
I think you will. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen them at Cactus Club when they play up here, and I'm definitely going to see that.
Yeah. Oh no. Oh, that'll be great. Oh man.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, it's weird to think to, you know, the Impulse thing, like, I wonder for how many people this will be the only Impulse album in there on their vinyl shelf, you know?
Well, yeah. And, you know, we were talking about the behind the scenes, the music stuff, but it's just an interesting choice, because if you're on Discord, it says something about your band. If you're on Impulse, it says something else.
Yeah.
Impulse says you're a jazz band.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it's like, really? This is not, you know,
you know, so what also happens sometimes when you get groups that are sort of when you have a situation like this where you have like different, you know, disparate groups of musicians coming together to build something new, what happens a lot in jazz to me is like sometimes the first record they make is like a little tentative, and then the second one is where they really sort of begin to stretch out and they find their groove. And maybe, you know, I hope this continues to be a collaboration, and that we have a couple more records ahead of us. I would love to have a chance to see these guys play live, you know, once a year or something like that for the foreseeable future. And you know, it might be, I'm thinking about like when all the young giants, like the, you know, Brad Meldow, Josh Redman, McBride and Brian Blade all got together again in like 2020 for the first time in, I don't know how many years, 25 years. And the first record they did together was like a little formal, a little stunted. And the second one was great, you know? So yeah. I'm wondering if there's some sort of like wearing in that needs to happen, and definitely playing live and maybe stretching themselves out a little bit will sort of help them find something new. As it is, this is a record that I would put on and I would recommend to people based on a sort of like mood, but I don't know that it's going to be a record that I listen to a lot, that I return to a lot, because there's a specific melody or a specific thing I'm looking for it.
Yeah, exactly the same thing. And I think seeing them progress in this lineup, because I think, you know, with the addition of Lewis, like, this is no longer the aesthetics. This is something different.
Yeah, right, right.
Seeing, like, how that explores and how they can explore whatever being on Impulse affords them now. And I'm not talking about money. I'm just talking about, like, creatively, like, what Impulse is like, we would like you to be like this. We would like you to do this, working with somebody who is strictly jazz, you know, James Brandon Lewis. See how that like elevates, maybe that elevates Canty and Lolly's playing in this space. And I don't want people to think that I'm saying like they aren't good players. They're amazing players. Notably like Lolly is like beyond what you ever heard of recording. Like he's just an amazing bass player.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it has to fit right. So maybe like you're right. Maybe this one is a little like stodgy, and the next one is a little like more freed up. They'll get out and play a bunch of shows, and then get right back in that studio.
Yeah,
yeah. We were talking about the Blue Note method of how they're doing stuff, and they're just like putting these like teams together for these albums and dropping people in. Like, okay, just do your dream project. Here it is. And you're like, you're probably going to see another Julian Lage album this year.
Right, right.
At the very least, you'll see it next year. So that's an album a year for like 4 years. And I think for bands like that and bands like this, that's what you need. It's not like a pop song. It's not like, you know, I'm going to get this. I don't have it yet, but I have I get all these, and maybe it'll be something I reach back for in like 6 years, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, no, I think this one, I'm interested to see how my perspectives on this change over time. I expect they will. But what I can say, and I think we've hit this point enough, is just if you're out there and have a chance to see these guys live, you should absolutely do that. This is a great live show. This is a great live band.
Yeah, for sure. Somebody I don't know who's going to be a live show, but I hear a lot of theorizing because this is like a sort of legendary, like almost reclusive artist, Prefuse 73.
Yeah,
he has a new album out called New Strategies for Modern Crime, Volume 1. He's had like a 20 or 30 year career. The big album for a lot of people is One Word, Extinguisher in 2003. I didn't actually hear about this artist until I was interviewing Nick Sanborn from Sylvanesso, and he just randomly brought it up and was like, dude, you have to hear this, and this is amazing. And I was like, oh man, you're right. And it also tracks like a lot of like his influences and how they get into Sylvanesso. So to say that this guy, his name is Guillermo Scott Heron, has been influential on the scene, I think is an understatement. But all his albums back then definitely played a lot more with hip hop. They remind me a lot of like Basshead, actually. So almost like an evolution of what Michael Ivey was doing. They have always been extremely cinematic. So you put on One Word, Extinguisher, and you're going to like take a journey. It's not a singles record. You have to listen to the whole thing. New Strategies for Modern Crime, Volume 1 is no different. This is, you know, him looking at New York and seeing the world around him and making sense of it. I know he said in interviews that he likes to work in the studio and have films running behind him. And so that he can like just turn around and see something and be inspired by it. That's a really rad way to do stuff. And like everybody I know has weird shit like that. But yeah, it shows in the music. So we're going to play a track from this right now. This is the second track on the album, A Lord Without Jewels. And you're going to go on a little journey. So here you go. Thank you. That's a little bit of a Lord Without Jewels off of New Strategies for Modern Crime, Volume 1. I know you said you haven't really checked in on this yet. So are you familiar with his previous material?
I am, yeah. So I am a big fan of Surrounded by Silence. Like, I remember the buzz around One Word Extinguisher. And it was like a very I for sure heard about these guys, about Guillermo from Pitchfork. And I really liked Surrounded by Silence because there were so many Wu-Tang guys on there. That was, you know, what I associate him with is this kind of like hazy but very clean, hip hop instrumental kind of a feel, almost sort of like something closer to DJ Shadow, but that was much closer to like a, you know, Jaga Jazzist or something like that. Like, I'm sort of a much more like organic kind of like vibey, jazzy, proggy thing.
Yeah, for sure. It's, and I think it comes from that film quality of it. I've listened to a good bit of One Word Extinguisher. I'm not that well versed in his catalog before this. I was drawn to this actually simply because that process is very appealing to me. That's like when I made The Lake. That's what it's supposed to be. A cinema. You're supposed to be thinking about some other stuff, painting pictures, and whether or not like I did my job right or he did his job right on his album is up to the listener. I think he does do his job right, and the whole thing is very down tempo, and it leaves you with a sense that you've experience something and you don't quite know how to feel about it. You feel good or bad about it. You're interested. You're extreme. This is like a super interesting experience that you had, but do I feel good? Do I feel bad? And I think that was his intent. Like, and that's a great way to be.
Yeah. This could be, this is a really interesting, you know, the other person this brings to mind a little bit for me is a guy, we played a track of his on the show before, Bastian Keb.
Yeah,
who also does sort of like auteur cinematic instrumental stuff that is like somewhere between like hip hop, soul, and just, you know, its own thing. I'm like scanning the discography now and realizing like how many things of his I have not heard over the last
under a bunch of different names too.
That's
the other thing. So this guy, like I said, this guy has a catalog going back like 30 years. This is a really good like point, I think, to jump in and just start working your way back if you hadn't heard him. One thing I found interesting about that track too is it starts off has like these slight like little Radiohead vibes. The question though is like, that seems obvious in 2024 that anybody would have that, but was he influenced by Radiohead, or was Radiohead influenced by like his sounds? Like, these aren't necessarily new sounds from him. This is just new work. I think it sounds a little bit more ambient than stuff that he's done in the past. But it's certainly like you can hear it and recognize, oh, that's Guillermo Scott Heron.
I'm gonna have a good time catching up on this stuff. To that point, I mean the opening notes, and the instrumentation sounded a lot like, you know, Everything in Its Right Place, I think, was the first sort of like, but, you know, he strikes me as someone who's just been so interested in like different sounds and textures and all that kind of stuff that like, it's sort of not, you know, I don't know. Radiohead doesn't get to claim credit for everything.
That's why I asked that.
Yeah.
you know, Radiohead brought up a lot of stuff. Like a lot of like popular artists do. They bring up stuff that is like underground in quotes.
Yeah.
And present it to the masses. They certainly did that on Kid A. Like if you think Kid A just came from like four white British dudes, I'm sorry. That's not that's not where that came from. But yeah, this is I keep going back to this. You know, we've talked in the past about uses for it. This is great if I'm coding.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know if an artist would want to hear that, but look, it's true. I mean, it's, you put this on, you're like, okay, you know, you're existing in another world while you create a world yourself. Yeah. That's the easiest way to put it. But like you, I'm going to be digging back into his catalog more to see what else is in there that I love to get like a better picture of him. We may actually have him on the show. There's we've been talking about him. He understandably is busy for one, but also I don't know that I would want to do interviews 30 years into my career so much.
Right.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it kind of, in many ways, takes the shine off the magic. It can.
Yeah, I have such a funny memory of that Surrounded by Silence record, because I had it on CD, and when I was, you know, I remember ripping it, and iTunes didn't know what to do with it. It was one of those, like, is this one artist, or is it various artists? Because there were so many guests, right? So like, so all of the tracks ended up in my library back when these things mattered, completely disjointed. Like they were just separate from each other. You couldn't, you know, like you had to create a separate playlist using the CD as a reference point to like reconstruct the album because Apple didn't know what the fuck to do with it. And I think it's like survived in my digital library in that format ever since then. I'm going to look this up in a second. But I think I still have this as like, you know, Surrounded by Silence is still like 12 different releases as opposed to one CD.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of that like that. Here's a hack. Just write down somewhere who all's the guest things and then just correct it to one in your iTunes.
Right.
Library. Have to learn that the hard way when you deal with advances.
Right.
Yeah, oh, so
that was great, man. That was great. I can't wait to get that.
If he goes out on tour, like I'm down. Yeah. I am 100% down. So this would be fascinating to see. Just a whole lifetime in music put into what he can do now.
I mean, there's a really interesting question there too about, you know, we talk all the time about, you know, who will survive in America? How are artists going to make it? And if you've made a career out of being someone who just kicks ass in the studio like he has, it's such a difficult, you know, it's almost the kind of thing where like when you and I are talking about up and coming bands, like we're always telling them like they should play live more. They should be right. Like they should be, you need to like, that's where you're going to make money. You're not going to make it selling music. You're going to make it by like getting people to come see you live. Right.
Right.
And, he's such a like, you know, opposite direction, of that, probably not unlike DJ Shadow. So,
It's, you know, and to our AI conversation, like in 5 years, could somebody make this with AI? Maybe.
Yeah.
That's horrifying. That's not meant to, that's no judgment on this work, the skill of this work. It's how much tech bros are going to pour into AI. I think what they can't get, which speaks to a lot of your point, is that he's always going to have the weight that his name carries.
Yeah.
That's currency. That's currency in every band. And that's, I mean, it pays to be popular. Let's put it that way. That's such a huge part of being a success. People just have to not just like your work, but be like, oh yeah, this is, people like working with you. People like, eventually they like what you represent.
Yeah.
Which is a different kind of fame.
Yeah. And his list of collaborators is a pretty impressive, you know, you've got the aforementioned Wu-Tang guest features. You've got like Sam Prekop from Sea and Cake. You've got Tortoise. You've got a lot of the sort of, you know, upper crust indie intelligentsia types.
So we talk about artists of all size on the show. We talk about like...
We do.
And big artists. Sometimes we talk to legends. With smaller artists, but we got one that you know a lot about.
Yeah, right, we celebrate music by our friends when they put music out. My brother is in this band called the Mad Archaic in San Francisco. I saw them play like a Phish after show on the night of that like 45-minute tweezer at the Greek Theater for all you nerds out there. They were a really, really fun band to see live. They haven't done a lot of recording. They've only got a couple of tracks out. You and I had talked about their previous release, which is a fun little number, but they just today, put out this song Glasses. It's on Bandcamp. I think it'll be on streaming soon enough. It's nice. It's a nice little follow-up. Their song before this was Ghost Car, which has sort of a very lush kind of 80s vibe. This Glasses is a song that I know from my brother because he's got a couple of great songs that he's written. Yeah. And I really love, it was really fun to hear the band's treatment of this song on this recording. So this is Glasses by the Mad Archaic. You know, one of the coolest things about having a younger sibling who writes great songs is you are always tempted to take a little bit of credit for that, which I'm not really doing. But it is really fun to hear, you know, our shared musical influences in his music when it comes out. I've always loved how my brother plays. I think he's a really sort of intuitive person who has a really great ear for sort of memorable harmonic moments and is always looking to sort of build a nice lyrical a nice lyrical statement with his voice or with an instrument. And I feel like that song accomplishes that. It gets in and out in like 3.5 minutes, and it's a hoppy little number.
Yeah,
it's fun, right?
Yeah, it's great. It's definitely like, so your brother, we should make it clear to people, your brother does love fish.
He does love
Jam Band. So if you heard many things.
Yeah.
I think I love your brother. He's great. He was on one or two shows. Like we every did, when he'd yeah. come through DC.
Yeah.
Such a great dude, but I guess I didn't realize he had the standard like Jam Band voice, singing voice, down pat. And man, does he have it down pat! Like you know,
Hafa, feel free to dig me if I'm wrong on this. But I think his approach to vocals is like 25%. You know, there's some Adam Duritz in there. There's some M. Doty from Soul Coughing. You know, there's about 30% of it I can't explain. It's just Hafa. But he really. He's a really good performer, man. I have to say that about him. I mean, you know, the whole band is really fun to see live. We saw them at a small place in Berkeley. Nice. But you know, I've seen my brother put on shows where it's just like basically like where it's his one man band project. It's him and a laptop and a guitar and a keyboard, and it's really, really impressive to like command people's attention when it's just you up there doing that.
And he did a lot of that in the pandemic too, right?
Yes.
He did a lot of online shows and stuff. I love that he's out there. I mean, because you have a brother, that's fantastic. Yeah. But I love that he's out there just from a musical standpoint, because this is what people who make music do. Is the Man Archaic ever going to be Beyonce sized? No. Why do you make music? Why do we do it? Why, you know, put ourselves through all this? There is the, well, I have no choice, which is a thing. But it's exciting when people make it work.
Yeah.
You know, he's not a kid. He's living his life. He's doing his thing, and he makes time to do this and the results and puts the effort in. The results are like, whoa, hey, what do you know? You can be a good musician if you actually do work at it.
Yeah, and you also have, you know, I don't know when he wrote this song. It's probably at least 10 years old. It might be more like 15 years old. And so you mm-hmm. also end up with these pieces of music that you've sort of like carried around with you for a long time. And they take on new life and new shapes. And, you know, the way you tell the story of that song isn't done yet because the song is still, you know, out there living and becoming something else. So,
That's spoiler for next week, actually, but, no, that's actually something that I found, two releases that I did is that, one of them on the lake has been around in some form for probably 15 years.
Yeah.
And this is before I put anything to tape. It's just, I know it.
Just stuff that you were sort of, you know, noodling on or working on or just like a progression that you liked playing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Progression. Yep. Sometimes it can be a whole song and you just never do anything with it. There's a value in just, we've talked about like output and like continuing to put out music. I'm a big proponent of that. Unless you think you can sit down and what you write is going to be that masterpiece, then take what you're inspired by and then do that. If you have the means to like keep doing it, just keep rolling it over and keep, so put out albums quick. You know, the weirdest thing about writing a song is that you get that idea and then you overthink it instead of just let it happen.
Yeah.
But you make space for it, but you don't get to be like your brother unless you've made space for it, is my point. And like all the musicians you know are doing this. You know, they're making space for it. Money, success affords that for sure.
Yeah.
That's why we don't want to see AI win.
Yeah. I think
that makes for happier people.
Yeah. I mean, it's just not. Yeah. I think there's, and look, if we end up in a situation where like half the population is fine with AI created shit and the other half isn't, and that becomes a new sort of red blue divide, like that's fine. I just think about the way the people who are closest to me think about, you know, what their approach to art is. And I don't mean so I'm not talking about just music. I'm talking about things that humans make to delight other humans. And so that could be food, it could be music, it could be a movie, it could be just being a funny person. Like, there's really never going to be, I just don't imagine a world where everyone is happy to sit back and be a passive consumer of what AI is giving them, as opposed to someone who is trying to make, create, and add something and put a little bit of yourself into the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope you're right, by the way.
Me too.
I mean, I may be doomer. I may be doomer about all this, but I'm definitely on the side of, like, I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
As we say many times, both of us are love it when we're wrong.
Yes.
Absolutely love it. Because you learn something. So as we wrap this up, we did not talk about James Blake's kind of Patreon, Vault FM.
Alternative. Yeah. We didn't talk about the Live Nation breakup thing that's going on. There's this great thing.
We'll talk more about that offline. That might be next week because I have questions about it. And there's the scalping won't fix the ticket resale market. What's a note? Counterpoint, sure it will. No, it's fine. I don't know who to reach out to. It would be a good person to have on for that, but I think a conversation with us and somebody else, maybe more than one person, about that, because that's a big issue. We see stuff like Light and Axis, you know, are offering these resale opportunities, like, in the app. You know, they keep it a closed system, which is what that always needed to be. And that's great. It's a matter of, like, how much that is, the scope of it, the scale of it, how far that goes out. Everybody needs to be using it, I think. And then you start to see this grind down at this dirty, dirty mob business, which is what it is at the end of the day.
Yeah. There's I was just talking to someone about this. Like, if you go to an airport today, it's really clear how there's a price on everything you do and every unit of time, right? Oh, you want to get off the plane sooner? Okay, that's an extra $20. You want to carry more stuff? That's an extra $50. You want to wait less time in line to get through security? Okay, that's a screening. That's a thing that you do, right? And it's really, there seems to be, you know, maybe this is hopelessly naive and idealistic, but I know I mentioned this to you when we were talking offline, but, you know, Jack Antonoff said something to the effect of, like, the minute you introduce those kinds of things into a concert crowd, you have killed the idea of a concert. You have made it something that is just this individualized experience that is all algorithmically driven based on, you know, these sort of, it stops being small D democratic. It stops being a situation where, like, we're all standing in line. And the only way to get to that spot first is to stand in line longer than someone else, right? This is the great thing about GA shows, is they're sort of, they democratize this kind of stuff, right?
Has Jack heard his algorithmically composed music? I joke, but, you know, that, yeah, you know, neither here nor
I think
there.
It's notable because he is someone who certainly is leaving money on the table, right? He could sort of lean into some dynamic pricing and probably have, you know, front rows of people who are all paying $5,000 a night to see him. And he was sort of saying, no, I don't want to play that kind of show. That kills the show for me. That kills the vibe.
And artists need to keep doing that.
Yes.
They need to find a balance. Definitely need to find a balance because the money is going to continue to dry up. But definitely the second you start doing that is when people start checking out. I mean, we just know that to be true. So, the only other thing we didn't get to, I'll leave you with this and then a preview of next episode. The Spotify Loud and Clear report came out, and this is like an annual thing that tells you where they are. It's obviously a lot of PR speak and stuff, but it actually has some, like, interesting numbers in it. And obviously people, if they put out anything, people are like, fuck Spotify, which I think is a good position, but also be able to understand that they are a business and understand their business. Because if you say fuck Spotify and you don't know anything about how they work, or why they work, or why they have to work that way, then it's not, you're not serving anything. One of the quotes in here I found interesting: today, streaming has enabled more room for more artists to find success, demonstrating real change across the music business. the overwhelming majority of artists on Spotify wouldn't have had music on the shelf in the CD era. So, just want to leave with that. Maybe we'll discuss further, but that's something for people to think about when they talk about these streaming services and what we need to do. I have solutions that I subscribe to. You have yours, you know, but I think we are going to end up really talking about this issue before the end of the season because it's important.
Yeah.
And people need to get paid.
Including whether there are simply too many musicians.
Yes, that's what that implies. Yeah. Not spoiler, but that's actually what that implies. Hard conversations, really hard conversations. But what wasn't a hard conversation is our next show. We're going to be talking to you about Bill Frisell's new album, Orchestras. And we're going to be talking about it with you with Bill Frisell. And so if you didn't know that now, now you do. I don't think either of us know how this happened, but it did. So, and is fucking fantastic. If you ever have the chance to talk to Bill Frisell, I highly recommend it. I don't know what to do with my weekend now. I want to like text him and see what's up.
We've peaked, man.
Yeah, we have peaked. So we're going to do that and we're going to go away forever. but so you might not get to talk to Bill Frisell, but you'll get to hear us talking to Bill Frisell. And it's and the real spoiler for that is that at the end of that, he said something that I've heard a lot of artists say. It carries a little extra weight coming from him. And basically, and I'm paraphrasing that, there's so much music inside everybody.
Yep.
And, it's good to hear. That's why we do the show. And, that's why we're going to keep doing it. So at any rate, 2 weeks for that. And then who knows after that, we'll have Ab on, maybe Guillermo on.
We got some good talks.
We need to set up some other talks.
Yeah.
I don't know. Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Let's call Bobby.
Okay,
old Mr. Zimmerman, old cranky pants, Mr. Zimmerman.
I'm gonna drop Bill's name. I'm gonna, hey man, you're no Bill Frisell. All right, talk to you guys soon.
Scholars.